Monster Man, special episode, Monsters and Bards. Hello, and welcome to Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great. I'm James Holloway, and I'm reading my way through the gaming books of yesteryear. And as I do, I'm taking a look at the monsters that I find in them, their history, their mythology, their ecology, their imagery, and how to use them in games. Today's episode is a special episode brought to you by the generosity and public spirit of my Patreon backers, and in particular, of Patreon backer James. If you'd like to be like James and get your own special episode, remember that all you have to do is go to patreon.com/monsterman and pledge at the $5 level. And if you do that, you'll also get access to the rewards for all other levels, including all new episodes of my other podcast, Patron Deities. So James, thank you very much for your support, and I hope that you enjoyed today's episode. James has asked me a very interesting question about the relationships between monsters and player characters. There are certain types of player characters that have monsters we associate with them. So, for instance, when you think clerics, you think undead. Indeed, the original cleric character was supposedly created specifically to be a vampire hunter. When you think of paladins, you tend to think of devils and demons, if only because of the paladin in hell illustration. These are extreme examples, of course, but could we think of other monsters that primarily face off against other classes? Specifically, James asks, what about bards? You know, bards are interesting. They've always been a class that struggles a little bit to fit in among the others. I mean, they're a relatively early addition to the game, but I wouldn't say they have the kind of iconic status that, say, paladins or barbarians do. The warlock, a fairly recent addition, relatively recent, has been adopted by the player base in a way that I think bards kind of haven't beyond a few stereotypes. Even when the D&D movie made a bard the protagonist, he's really just a rogue that knows how to play an instrument. Now, this is funny because bards are actually pretty classic adventure and fantasy adventure protagonists, right? There's a whole category of Norse sagas known as the warrior poet sagas, and even sagas that fall outside that category often have poets in them, like Eyjolf Skallagrimsson in Eyjolf Saga. There's Allan a Dale from Robin Hood and His Merry Men. In the modern world, you've got Silver John. I think of him mainly as a historian, but Ahmed Ibn Fadlan, the historical character, is presented in The Eaters of the Dead as a poet. Like, I feel like there's a lot of them. And it makes sense because historically, entertainers of various kinds were people who went from place to place, meeting all kinds of different people. They had unique skills. Historically, the term bard applies more to poets than musicians and implies a kind of high social status that's associated with being responsible for keeping the community's history and lore and maybe even laws. But I think for our purposes, we can assume that a bard might be some sort of musical mystic, might be a court poet, or maybe a wandering balladeer or other kind of entertainer. So if we're looking to think about what it is that the bard does in a game, what is the bard's distinctive feature? Narrowly, it's art. But more broadly, bards are the social skills character class. They do diplomacy and subterfuge. Some versions of D&D have kind of struggled to turn this into a distinct role. Like, if you look at 5th edition, the bard is sort of a mixture of different elements, kind of loosely thematically connected to the idea of being a performer. I had a bard in my original D&D game, which started with 3rd edition and then moved into 5th edition, who was multi-classed bard barbarian. Some odd combinations are possible, but the idea, again, was sort of a warrior poet. But I do think that even though the bard has sometimes struggled to fit into the game at large, we can infer, from what we know about it, some things about the types of antagonists against which bards might excel. The first and most obvious antagonist for a bard is a person. The bard is the most people-forward of all the D&D character classes, being someone who really needs an audience, which probably means a society. Like, I don't necessarily mean a human being, but a sentient being, or the kind of creature that is capable of appreciating art and culture. And that can apply to a lot of different situations. So it could be, trying to persuade hesitant neutral types to join your side, like C-3PO in Return of the Jedi. It could be doing diplomacy to get different groups to work together, like, Lawrence in Lawrence of Arabia. It could be trying to create in order to get someone to spare your life, like Eyjolf Skallagrimsson in Eyjolf Saga, who I mentioned earlier, right? He has this famous poem, the title of which is Head Ransom, the idea being that it's the poem that he's making in order to get out of being executed. And this makes a certain kind of sense, right? That the bard serves in many ways as the party's face. That's all fine. I think we're used to the idea of one of the roles that a party might have being the one who's the front, who does the talking. But that doesn't necessarily mean that they're artists. Sophie Devereaux from Leverage is a bard, and, you know, I guess insofar as anyone on Leverage is not a rogue, but Sophie Devereaux is very explicitly not a good artist, right? She's a bad actress who somehow becomes great when she's actually lying to people. So if we're going to make sure that there's art in our bard rather than just charm, we have to include it in those interactions. We have to be in societies that prize the bard's art in some way. But this can be a little tricky. Like, if you are reading a Norse saga, you get the actual poetry. Indeed, in many cases, the event in the saga that you're reading has been created to provide a context for a poem that was already known and existed. So strange elements of some part of the narrative will be there because they need to explain a reference that's in the text of the poem. And that's just part of the fun. But in a game, I don't know that it necessarily is, right? Not everyone who plays a bard in a game is going to be a songwriter like James, who requested this episode, is. But I would say that that is relatively rare. Most people who play bards don't perform at the table, and to be perfectly honest, if they did, it would probably get old pretty fast. So some of the impact of a scene in which a bard character, like, wins someone's heart by composing a poem is going to be lost if the player just says, "I write a poem," rather than actually writing one. But on the other hand, we also probably don't want to sit and have all the other players do nothing for a couple of minutes while one player reads his poetry. And that's if the poetry is good. That kind of passivity is something you want only in small doses. So there are some differences between the traditional narrative of the poet diplomat and the role of the poet diplomat at our gaming tables. But in general, I would say that intelligent creatures that can put a bard into tricky or social diplomatic situations, they're kind of the bard's bread and butter. And the more civilized, the more likely they might be to appreciate art, or the more you want to make the point that they can appreciate art even though they're not quote-unquote civilized, the better. But you don't need me to tell you that. Let's get a little more esoteric. What about monsters who have some kind of connection to music or art? What about monsters who are themselves performers or who have singing or magical music as part of their deal? So the most obvious example of this would be something like a siren or a Lorelei, right? A creature that enchants its prey using a magical voice. This is an area where, in 5th edition, the bard's countercharm ability could come in handy. The problem with countercharm is that, in 5e terms, it's pretty boring, since for best effect, you should do it before the thing you're trying to counter starts, and it takes your action so you can't do too many other things while you're doing it. Although I guess bards have got some good bonus action options, but in general it's, I don't know, you run the risk of basically wasting a turn if you counter charm and then it turns out not to be needed, or of coming in too late. Still, even leaving aside the mechanical aspect, I think that creatures like this can work well for the bard. It could be a direct competition where the bard is trying to save other people from the creature's charm. You know, we know that the Lorelei is luring people down to the river to fall in and drown, and we need to use the bard singing to distract people from the Lorelei singing. Or alternatively, you could be trying to learn the monster's enchanting song. You actually could assemble a pretty good set of monsters from creatures that have songs with supernatural effects or other kinds of vocalizations. We'd have to redo some of them, but we've already talked about monsters that entrance people, like the siren. We have monsters that have songs that put people to sleep, so like in AD&D, when satyrs play their pipes, people go to sleep. We have songs, or at least vocalizations, that cause fear, like those of the Debbie. I'm sure we could get a song in there that causes fear. We could even rejig the Banshee to work with this idea, since, as you know, I've never been very convinced by the Banshee's wail just striking people dead, right? What if it caused fear instead? You could have more explicitly mind control type songs where whatever is sung, you know, while accompanied by a certain instrument has that mind control effect. You could even say that these monsters were created by these songs, right? What is a siren beyond its song? Or maybe the siren is the song personified. You know, at the beginning of time, the creator or the god of music or the talking god or whoever created all these songs, but they got accidentally released into the world, and each of these monsters has one, but if you defeat one, you could learn the song. And maybe you could have an unscrupulous bard antagonist who's running around trying to collect them all, trying to not record the lore of these creatures for posterity, but learn their powers so that they can use those songs for, you know, personal gain or revenge or whatever. Also, monsters that are themselves music or art could be a fun antagonist for a bard. And, you know, like the musical monsters, they have the advantage that they can also provide opposition for everyone else, which is, you know, an important thing to have in a fantasy adventure game, right? I mean, if you consider the example of the cleric, even though clerics are especially good at fighting undead, like, rangers and barbarians can also fight undead. I know that's obvious, but it's something that's important to remember in a party-focused game. One player's time to shine shouldn't necessarily be every other player's time to kick rocks. You don't want to put the whole party into a situation where the only thing they need to do is sing, and none of them can sing. But we could have song monsters that get really abstract, right? So, for instance, let's say we have a song that acts as a kind of mental virus. This is a concept that actually works pretty well if you think about the nature of music in pre-modern societies, or prior to the introduction of the printing press. We don't know very much about how popular music worked, but I would presume that most musicians learned songs by hearing them rather than by reading them. And we know that quite long poems could be transmitted orally, and that they could mutate a bit over time. And the same goes for folk music, although most of what we think of as folk music is actually a bit later than that. It is from an age when printed ballad sheets were the norm. But those songs would then be reinterpreted and performed in different ways, and so on. So the idea of someone learning a song and then singing it for someone else, and now they know it, right? We already have this idea of information as a virus, and that, of course, could certainly apply to music. This model of transmission means that you could have a fun time with this kind of earworm monster. It could be something that's transmitted through a song that causes hearers to behave in a certain way, a bit like the mind control idea I mentioned previously, but where the power is inherent in the song itself. Like a murder ballad that makes people want to commit murders in the style of the song, or a marching song that makes people want to join the army. It might even be a song that actually transforms people into a particular kind of creature. Like, let's say you hear a song about wolves, and that makes people actually turn into werewolves. This feels like a monster that could be the culmination of an investigation-type scenario, right? You hear that there have been some werewolf killings in the village or whatever, and you investigate, you stay at the inn, you meet the traveling balladeer who's also staying there. Eventually, you track down the werewolf. It's not the traveling balladeer. But then you hear there's been another werewolf killing in the next village over, even though you got the previous werewolf, so you're like, huh, I guess there's more than one of them. But when you go to that village, there's the traveling balladeer staying at the inn. One nice thing about moving a song or a poem or some other kind of performance to the front of this story is that you could write that up if it's short enough and have clues in it and so on, which is a little more accessible than trying to create or perform every song that a character does. To put this at the kind of like high culture end of the scale, an obvious instance of this would be something like the play The King in Yellow, right? The central conceit that this play is so blasphemous and horrid and it drives people mad and so forth. Now, in that instance, I wouldn't recommend trying to actually write the play The King in Yellow because most of the time, you're not going to be able to come up with something that's so wild that it justifies the way people react to and think about The King in Yellow in the stories. I actually have a copy of a play written by a playwright called Thomas Ring, which I believe was performed, I want to say in Portland, Oregon, but I could be wrong about that. And it's fine. It's quite eerie and weird, which I like, but I don't know that it extended a malign influence into my life. You'd have to think about mostly presenting this stuff through its effects on other characters. And, you know, this play is only one example. You could get cosmic or folksy with it. Like, you could put a fun gothic spin on it, a bit like The King in Yellow, by having it be written by some infamously evil poet, right? Some depraved, Byronic bad guy who wrote this thing as he was dying and somehow transmitted his spirit into it, his identity into that final composition, so that he could be reborn whenever the poem fell on the right ears or was spoken by a bard of sufficient ability. And it could be something, you know, one of the ways in which we could bring in the bard characters to have this thing really only affect poets. So your fellow bard, something is wrong with them, or it's seeking you out because it knows that only bards have the kind of poetic sensibility necessary to understand this. Alternatively, if we think of the poems, songs, and stories that bards retell as being repositories of lore for a society, that lore could actually concern monsters, right? Now, in various different editions of D&D, bards have those kinds of lore skills, but you could also get meta with it. Maybe we have a monster who has certain abilities that are found in songs, but it's actually the songs themselves that make it have the weaknesses it has. So the bard's creativity could come into play there as it created things about the monster. All possibilities. What if we're dealing with monsters that have opinions about music? Darkseid always hated music, as Final Crisis tells us. You know, maybe there are monsters that have a problem with bards and the music or poetry that they sing. This can actually be a good way to pit a player character against the good guy monsters that we often don't have so much use for, as discussed in many previous episodes. So you have some lawful good angel or Lamasu or whatever, and it's helping out your party. Not Lamasu. Are Lamasus are bad guys and Shedus are good guys? Anyway, whichever one. But it really disapproves of this chaotic good dirtbag, and let's face it, 99% of bards are chaotic good. Neutral good. Tops, you know, disapproves of this honey-voiced rascal going around singing a bunch of songs glorifying drinking and fornication and crime. Listen, I mean, I know we all want to stop Dark Lord Zergithrax, but would it kill you to clean up your act? You're glorifying the Cat Lord, making people want to be like him, and he's a thief. This kind of ties in again with the sort of rascally balladeer bard idea. I don't know why. I tend to think of the D&D bard as a wandering balladeer, and I know that that's not necessarily what they're like. It's not what the bard in my campaign that I play in is like, or the bard in the campaign that I run. But I don't know, somehow I like the idea that they're performing catch penny early modern ballads about a criminal's confession on the gallows. A lot of early modern ballads are about a guy who's getting hanged and he's sad about it. And it's kind of a reefer madness type situation, by which I mean that the purpose of this ballad is actually to listen to all the gory details of a crime and get a vicarious thrill through it while still acting like what you're really here for is the anti-crime moral and the bit at the end where he says you should not do crimes and instead you should go to church and don't drink whiskey. Now, I'm assuming that you're not going to have some kind of like musical final confrontation with this creature, right? Unless this is an all bards all the time campaign and you're going to end with some kind of bend before the ways of heavy metal guitar duel. There's probably fun to be had with that idea, but I don't know that it's sustainable across the length of a whole campaign. I just feel like your ideologically motivated monsters might be the ones that are most likely to have opinions of some kind about music, or art in general. You know, do demons hate music because the whole system of the mathematical representation of sound is about the most lawful thing you can imagine? Or do they love it because it allows people to express feelings and ideas that society's rules don't give them more of a way to express? Or how about the fair folk, right? Fairies in general seem like a good companion monster for bards because they are said to love music and art. So we can imagine some fairy prince falling in love with a great actor and going to grab him and take him back to the land of fairy where, you know, the way time flows differently will preserve his talent and beauty forever. It could even be a thing like, is it the 23 Club, that idea, that, or the whatever it's called club, that idea that like great rock stars don't live past a certain age? You know, what if the reason that famous bards don't live past a certain age is because they get abducted and taken away to the land of fairy to, you know, strum a harp while fairy youths gamble. That is nice because it sort of creates simultaneously like a supernatural, you know, procedural problem, but also a diplomatic problem for the bard. Because this creature, this monster, whatever, is doing something because it is a fan of the bard and the bard's work. So you can't necessarily just attack them. They're just kind of misguided and weird. You also might need to go and replace the kidnapped bard or sabotage the actor's performance so that the fairies sour on him, you know? It's both something that's related to art as the bard's central idea, but also includes a lot of the social and diplomatic elements that are otherwise where the bard excels. Get a little bit of comedy and manners in there. You can't fight your way into the fairy court. You have to manipulate them. I like that idea, the idea of having a monster that is a fan of the bard where that's a problem. Some supernatural being, whether it's a giant's child or a fairy prince who has just gone all in on that kind of parasocial relationship. And they might even think they're trying to help, you know, or they might just be obsessive. Maybe the giant's child wants to take this wonderful human singer to the, you know, crude hall of, I mean, I guess a giant's child would be a giant, but you know what I mean? Like a giant child wants to take some wonderful human singer back to the crude hall where the giants live, because there's no music that beautiful in Giantland. Or maybe some starstruck kobold is following you around and just getting into arguments with everyone who's ever rude to you or criticizes you, basically being a little magical reply guy. Of course, a lot of these examples that I've used have been musical, and bards aren't necessarily musicians, although I would say they are traditionally singers and poets. But I think that you can apply a lot of these ideas to any kind of performance, right? Bards are broadly in, like, the performing arts. So that gives us diplomatic situations that require the bard's social skills to get out of, and therefore focusing primarily on intelligent, civilized monsters. Maybe not necessarily civilized. You can have intelligent wild monsters. So for instance, you can definitely see the bard charming a lonely stone maiden, performing for her in order to get her to reveal some secret to the party or something like that. I think Al-Kadim, the idea that, you know, poets are held in kind of high social esteem, it could be very relevant. We've also got monsters that practice the same art in some way, monsters that have views or opinions on the bard's art, and monsters that are art. Is that anything? I think the monsters that are art in particular has some kind of legs to it, and I like the idea of bards being essentially celebrities and having the problems that come with those, but depending on your game, that might not be something that applies to monsters necessarily. So I hope that some of those ideas are useful, and James, thank you once again for your support, and I hope that you enjoyed today's episode. Everyone else, remember that if you'd like to be like James and get your own special episode, all you gotta do is go to patreon.com/monsterman and pledge at the $5 level. And if you do that, you'll also get access to the rewards for lower levels, including all new episodes of my other podcast, Patron Deities. Over the next few weeks, we've got a mixture of episodes. We are wrapping up the Al-Kadim season. We've also got a couple of fun My Favorite Monster episodes coming up. And then I'm going to do a run of specials between the end of the Al-Kadim season and the beginning of the next one, which I haven't decided what it is yet. So stick around here and you'll find out right here on Monster Man, a show about monsters because monsters are great. Thank you for listening. If you've got a favorite monster or something you'd like me to talk about, why not get in touch? I'm on Twitter as @GonzoHistory, on Mastodon as GonzoHistory@dice.camp, or you can find me on Instagram at MonsterManGonzo, or drop me an email, GonzoHistory@gmail.com. Our theme music is an extract from Solve the Damn Mystery by Jesse Spillane from the album Descent of the Goober Monster and is used under a Creative Commons Attribution License. Our cover art is by Ray Otis. Thanks for listening, and please join me next time for Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great.